City of Charlottesville et al. Versus Payne et al. Lisa A. Robertson, John C. Blair II, Appellants Counsel, Ralph E. Main Jr., Scott B. Puryear, Kevin C. Walsh, Appellees Counsel.
Ms. Robertson, you may begin.
Thank you. May it please the court, I'm Lisa Robertson, appearing for the City of Charlottesville and Charlottesville City Council. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. This case involves the interpretation of Virginia Code Section 15.2-1820 in a related statute, which authorizes and regulates specified memorials for veterans. Many legal issues have been briefed by the parties in this appeal. This morning, I will organize my remarks around facts. There are two indisputable and dispositive facts which individually or in combination require judgment in favor of the city on all legal issues. Fact number one, plaintiffs never asserted there was actual physical damage or harm to the statues. Fact number two, Charlottesville statues were not installed pursuant to any state enabling legislation, general or special, which expressly authorized them to be erected as any type of war memorial and regulated as such. Fact one, within its letter opinion dated January 21, 2000, the trial court acknowledged, and I quote, plaintiffs never asserted that there was actual physical damage or harm to either of the statues. Because of this fact, Payne had no statutory standing to bring any action or claim against the city under the provisions of 15.2-1812.1, including declaratory or injunctive relief and attorney's fees. Section 15.2-1812.1 authorized an action to recover monetary damages necessary for purposes of damage to a pre-encroachment physical condition. Nothing else. On November 9th, 2018,
Council, yes, would a tarp be an encroachment?
The trial court judge determined that the tarp was an encroachment. The trial court did not find any damages arising out of that encroachment. On November 9th, 2018, almost a year before the trial court entered an order dismissing with prejudice all claims seeking an award of damages based on physical harm to either statue. After that order, it was impossible for the Payne plaintiffs to prevail in the one and only action authorized by Section 1812.1, and the award of attorney's fees was erroneous and an abuse of discretion by the plain language paragraph C of 1812.1.
Counsel, this is Justice Kelsey. If I may interrupt you with a question. These statues were erected in the 1920s, am I right?
That's correct.
And up until 1997, the 15.2-1812 and its predecessor statutes applied only to counties. Am I right there?
That is correct.
And the city of Charlottesville was incorporated in the late 1800s. Is that also true?
Yes.
So is there any legal principle for applying this statute retroactively to a statute that was authorized and permitted to be erected in the 1920s by a city?
We believe that there is not, and that is the basis of our argument as to why Section 15.2-1812 did not apply at all. Now, there were some cities that did receive special acts of approval via special acts of assembly to erect monuments, but those monuments, Charlottesville statues, were not among those monuments.
So let me stop you there. So prior to 1997, if a city wanted a specific approval by the legislature to avoid any Dillon Rule argument or something like that, they would get special legislation for their charter to do that, which would seem to imply that the legislature understood that a county was not a city and a city is not a county.
That is correct. Yes, that is our argument.
What do you make of the assertion that this was a code commission change and it was just wordsmithing?
Well, the code commission certainly indicated that they were wordsmithing when they recodified Title 15.1 throughout the title. The word locality was often substituted where in places where the only a reference to county or only a reference to cities had previously appeared. But if you look within this statute and you look at in particular at the word such, which connects the enabling clause to the regulating clause, and that was the same structure and format that the statute had prior to 1997, and quite frankly, the same format used in many of the special acts of assembly, it seems clear that the 1997 recodification only intended to include monuments and memorials that had previously been regulated by that statute.
Well, counsel, I understand the technical legal argument, and there's some logic to that, but why would the legislature draw a distinction between protecting one, say, I mean, I know these are Civil War memorials, it comes freighted with this emotional response, but a World War II memorial or a Vietnam War memorial, why would the legislature mean to protect the not all memorials for those wars, but only the ones that went through a certain legal path to be erected? Why would that those only those benefit from protection? It seems I follow the logic of your legal argument, but in terms of the policy of the legislature, why would they have meant to take that path?
So in this particular statute, there has never been a purposes clause. Likewise, there's never been a purposes clause in any of the special acts of assembly. So we have to look at the words within the statute. I also think that we have to be careful about using the word protection, which was the issue that the trial court struggled with quite a bit. But for over 100 years, 1812, Section 15.2, 1812, and its predecessors, and also none of the special acts of assembly which prohibited disturbance or interference or removal, none of those statutory provisions provided any action for enforcement of those prohibitions. And so if by protection one is referring to the ability to punish someone who harms a monument. Certainly there are other laws that prohibit people from damaging public property, from defacing public property. If by protecting one is referring to what a locality may do with its own property, I think that takes us into the realm of a substantive or vested rights analysis, which requires us to look at the wording of the statute itself and to also look at the specific enabling legislation that served as the authority to erect the monument in the first place. And this case is has some significant parallels to the Richmond versus Henrico Board of Supervisors case, 1887, in which Virginia Supreme Court said, absolutely, a locality that is the owner of property is entitled to protection even against change in regulation at the state level once it has established a public use on its property. And what we have always believed is that by the wording of these statutes, the word structure, very specifically the direct and tight connection between the authorizing clause and the regulating clause, we have a scheme of state regulation that was set up. To get into that scheme, if you want to jump into the pot, you had to have had the benefit of the enabling legislation provided by this statute. And if you erected your war memorial as a war memorial intentionally under the authority of that state enabling legislation, you were aware when you did it that your rights as a property owner were going to be less than you had with respect to your other property, and you were going to be well aware that you were going to have some duties and obligations that you wouldn't otherwise have for your other property. And that's just not the case with Charlottesville statutes.
So when, counsel, when you make the reference to the regulating clause, you're speaking of the former language in subsection A, if such are erected, it shall be unlawful, right?
That's correct. And even in the 2020 amendments, you'll see that that structure is preserved. There's an opening clause that enables certain veterans memorials to be erected. And then there's a new regulating clause. The new legislation isn't simply a Dillon's Rule authority, expression of authority to erect a monument. It still has regulations. They have just been changed from formerly preemptive and prohibitive regulations into regulations that specify what a locality, what requirements must be satisfied before a locality can remove or contextualize or do other things with these monuments. And if you'll note, at the end of the 2020 legislation, the legislature requires the Department of Historic Resources to promulgate regulations that will govern how something can be contextualized. So there are still state regulations associated even with the amended law. They are just, they're more permissive. So as I was saying, the fact that there's no physical damage or harm ever alleged by the plaintiffs in this case is dispositive of all of the claims based on the provisions of 15.2, 18.12.1.
Counsel, could a court award nominal damages? It says you can recover damages. It says the court can award damages necessary to rebuild, etc. But one typical remedy, like in the civil rights context, is nominal damages to vindicate the dignitary interest of someone whose rights have been damaged, but they don't have physical harm, loss of wages, that type of thing. And so are damages limited to only the rebuilding, et cetera, or could damages include nominal damages as in other perhaps distantly analogous statutes?
In this instance, under the provisions of 18.12.1, I do not believe nominal damages would have been appropriate. The wording of the old law as well as the new law states that damages may be awarded in such amounts as necessary for the purpose of rebuilding, repairing, preserving, and restoring. As we have specified in our briefs, we believe that the correct way to interpret that string of words is as referring to some physical alteration of the condition of the monument. And if there was no harm to that monument, there is no need for any amounts of damages necessary to rebuild them. And in fact, when the trial
But doesn't that write out the encroached upon out of? Because you could encroach upon something without physically damaging it. I mean, you could put, a humiliating or a whatever, a magnetic thing, or you see what I'm saying? Where so
yes.
That's my concern, is giving expression to all the words of the statute. I understand your point about damaging, but the statute says encroaching. Could that therefore signal possibly nominal damages?
I still believe that it doesn't signal that. I think that the words here suggest that the legislature intended to offer a mechanism by which a damaged monument could be returned to a pre-encroachment condition. I think the trial court Certainly in its damages order, the trial court regarded this the same way. What the trial court did, and we assert he should not have read injunctive relief into the statute, but what the trial court did was say this was an encroachment and I'm going to prohibit you. I declare it to have been an unlawful encroachment and I'm going to prohibit you from encroaching in the future. But the trial court did agree with us that no damages were necessary for the purposes listed in this code section.
Thank you. All right, your time has expired.
Thank you.
Professor Walt, you may proceed.
Thank you. Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'm Kevin Walsh. I represent the Monument Fund, and I will be arguing on behalf of all appellees, respondents today. Now, the appellees and respondents, that's the same set of people. I emphasize the two different designations because you have before you an appeal with the four assignments of error. That is to be decided under the law in effect at the time. And then you have a motion to dissolve, which is to be decided under new law, law that's never been applied. And as to that new law, I would just say at the outset, that is for the circuit court to apply in the first instance. That's not for this court to apply as an appellate court. The only issues before you are the issues raised in the assignments of error. Now, to go directly to the two points raised by my friend on the other side, the words physical damage appear nowhere in 15.2-1812.1. There are four purposes that are listed for which damages may be awarded, and those include preserving as well as restoring to pre-encroachment condition. And of course, tarps are an encroachment, and they were restored to pre-encroachment condition by the order that they were to be removed. Now, additionally, this is a very strong private right of action. It only kicks in if the authorities of the locality fail to act. And in 1812.1-C, it provides for mandatory award of attorney's fees as part of litigation costs. Further, the damages includes litigation costs. So the language that my friend on the other side is referring to, it says, damages other than those litigation costs recovered from any such action shall be used exclusively for the purposes, so for example, preserving or restoring to pre-encroachment condition. So the legislature, when it passed this private right of action in 1999, after this was applicable to all localities, intended that there be private...
Professor, may I interrupt you for a second and ask you a question about that last point? 1812.1, as you point out, refers back to 1812, but prior to 1997, 1812 didn't apply to the city, and the monuments were obviously erected with the permission of the city prior to the statute's existence. So, logically speaking and literally speaking, I'm struggling with whether or not this statute can be interpreted to go back in time to the 1920s. Now, I see where the Code Commission has made their statement, but our duty is to read statutes as they're written, not as they should have been written.
Absolutely, Justice Kelsey. And textually, the question that we're looking at is, what was the law in 2017 when Charlottesville ordered these monuments removed? That was the law that was it wasn't 1996, 1997, 1920. It was the law after it applied to the city, after the private right of action was enacted, after the criminal vandalism prohibition, which also has the exact same coverage as 1812, was added to the books. So in the law as it stood in 2017, it said, if such are erected, it shall be unlawful for the authorities of the locality to disturb or interfere. So textually then, the question is, what is such? Well, it refers back to monuments or memorials for any war or conflict. So the first sentence provides authorization. There may be authorization, as my friend on the other side pointed out, to erect monuments or memorials in other places. For example, Charlottesville authorized and permitted the erection of these monuments in beautifying parks. But under the city's logic, such also requires that you do a factual and legal genealogy of every single monument in order to determine whether it is covered by the law. So, for example, if there is a criminal vandalism prosecution under Virginia Code 18.2-137 for someone who vandalizes the Jackson Monument or the Lee Monument, if the city is correct, then the defendant can win by saying that that prohibition doesn't cover the law, it doesn't cover the monument because it was not erected pursuant to the authorization in this first sentence. Now, that it really doesn't make any sense that the legislature would do that, and the text certainly doesn't compel it. It's not even naturally read to do that. Such refers back to
Can I stop you for 1 second? And without arguing with your point, because you make a good point, but prior to 1997, did it make any sense that this statute and the collateral statutes would only apply to county-authorized erections of monuments? Because it seems as though that was a purposeful choice of words.
Right, and then the purposeful expansion of the law to cover all monuments in all localities was to ensure a uniform rule of preservation and protection. This is something that
I can
very
see the
important.
Public policy for that, to be sure, but I'm still looking for text that makes it clear, because we have a presumption against any retroactivity. I'm looking for a text that makes clear that, you know, after making the distinction between cities and towns versus counties for all these years, and then having special legislation specific to cities for all these years for monuments, if they wanted to go back and sweep everything, I would expect there to be something that says that, and I'm still looking for it.
It is right there. It says, if such are erected, and then it says, any monuments or memorials. It used to, in 1988, say, it shall thereafter be inappropriate to interfere or disturb. They deleted thereafter. This is the language of any that this court in Sussex Community Services said, any means any. There is no temporal restriction, and to the extent that almost 30 years prior to the city acting, they took out anything that can be construed that way, is strong evidence that they meant what they said. Any means any. Such means monuments or memorials. It does not
incorporate. I'm sorry to interrupt again, but what any are you looking at? I'm only looking at 1812 subsection A. A locality may ... erect monuments or permit them. And then the next sentence, if such are erected. So, well, their answer to that is, well, we didn't erect this under this statute, and we couldn't have.
Sure. The language is further in the very same sentence. If such are erected, it shall be unlawful for the authorities of the locality, right, city, county, town, the authorities of the locality, or any other person or persons, to disturb or interfere with any monuments or memorials so erected. So erected means it has to be erected. So, for example, there's arguments.
Well, a monument's not going to exist if it's not erected, all right? So it's superfluous if you're trying to just say monuments are erected. If they weren't erected, they're not monuments. I guess the problem is the first sentence seems to imply that you're talking about monuments erected with the authorization of the statute. That's what the implication seems to me. Tell me why I'm reading it incorrectly.
Sure. The coverage of this second sentence is also the same as the coverage of 18.2-137. It's also the coverage of 1812.1. And you are reading in a limitation that is not there. With respect to the question of a monument wouldn't exist if it's not erected, I would suggest that, for example, some have argued that the naming of schools for Confederate people is a memorial. Well, that would be foreclosed by 1812. And so what it says is if it's erected, right, and that's a present tense. It doesn't say if it's previously erected or erected after 1997, there is no temporal limitation. And that's what was decisive to this court in Sussex Community Services. Now, that's assuming your premise, with which I also disagree, that there's any retroactive application, because retroactivity is measured by the activity being regulated. Here, the activity that's being regulated is disturbance or interference. Once this law is on the books, the city of Charlottesville and every other locality, which had no problem understanding the plain meaning of this, was prohibited from disturbing or interfering with those memorials. And so retroactivity doesn't exist at all once you identify the proper activity. And secondly, even if it did, your analysis in Sussex Community Service, as well as the five or six cases that relied on, shows that this text is enough. And the alternative reading doesn't make any sense. So we're offering a reading that not only makes sense of the text, that doesn't insert text that's not there, and that also fits the preservative, expansive, uniform application. The point of the recodification was to clean up that whole section of the code. And they did that by making sure that people who vandalize monuments don't get to say, oh, well, that was put up in 1920, or that was put up pursuant to something else. There's all sorts of ways that monuments and memorials can be erected. And only the plain reading that does not put any other words in provides that uniform protection. It also doesn't make sense for the same legislature in 1997 to expand these protections, to have a criminal vandalism prohibition that requires this type of genealogical inquiry. And we should not attribute that kind of intention to the legislature. So that's on the assignment of error four. That's the city's fourth one. Going back to their first one, the attorney's fees go to a prevailing party. We prevailed. The monuments are still standing. We received declaratory relief, injunctive relief, and because we're prevailing parties, we are statutorily entitled to the mandatory attorney's fees. Now, the law has changed, and with that change in law, Charlottesville is able to take down its monuments if it wishes. But I wish to be very clear about this. The city's position on so-called retroactivity also implies, and this is on page 4 of the reply brief, also implies that their new the new legislation does not apply to them. So the current General Assembly provided a procedure. They said there's a 30-day notice, followed by a vote, followed by another 30 days. And the city's position is that they don't have to follow those procedures either. That's why they're asking for the injunction to be dissolved entirely. Their position is that the law just doesn't apply. Now, any lawyer who kind of is advising in a locality who would pick up this code provision, I think would say, are these monuments or memorials for any war or conflict? Absolutely they are. Okay, are they erected? Yes. Well then, you're not allowed to disturb or interfere with them. That's very straightforward. On the alternative approach, the next question should be, well, what was the precise enabling legislation by which it got there? Because it turns out that we have this scheme where otherwise they're not protected. I don't think that's what the General Assembly intended. That's certainly not what they did. And for that reason, we ask that you affirm Judge Moore's orders and deny the city's motion to dissolve. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, both sides' time has expired.